for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I am so thrilled today. We are going to be talking royal weddings. Oh, wow. This is exciting. My guest is Leslie Carroll, who has written a book called American Princess, The Love Story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. Hi, Leslie. Are you there? Leslie? Hi, Leslie. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
Okay.
Good morning.
Okay, good morning. And you're up there early in mountain time, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, it is so good to talk to you again. As I was telling you before, you were one of my very first guests here on Joy on Paper, and I can't believe it's 3 years. I just celebrated the third anniversary.
Wow, happy anniversary, and it's a joy to be back.
Well, and particularly for this exciting book. This is so wonderful. How thrilling it is for you to write a book about the wedding that's coming up, and of course you are, I'm sure that many of my listeners certainly know that I have spoken of the Marie Antoinette trilogy quite often, because I love that you are such a great historical writer.
And
so you are just ideal for this position of writing about the wedding, because you were actually, you were at the wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton. And you covered that for CBS News, right?
Right. I covered it for CBS News. And this is actually, well, American Princess is my 21st book baby and my 7th nonfiction book on the loves and lives of European royals. And I do usually write about dead royals. You're right. People like Marie Antoinette, that's usually my bailiwick. And I started writing about Marie Antoinette when I researched her life for one of my nonfiction books, Notorious Royal Marriages. So, I usually write about dead royals, and some of my nonfiction books had covered living royal couples of Charles and poor Diana and Charles and Camilla. And then when I went to the marriage of William and Kate, I used their marriage had been the final chapter in my book, Royal Romances. And so I started getting interested, of course, in living royals. And Prince Harry and Meghan Markle is literally the most groundbreaking royal relationship in the 1,000-year royal monarchy in Britain. I mean, they check off every box that would have been taboo even a generation ago, with Prince Charles.
Because, of course, Meghan is divorced. We know what happened to a previous divorced American.
Exactly. well, there are a lot of reasons for that, which we can go into if you want to. But, yes, she's divorced. She's American. And I have to remind your listeners that there is nothing in Britain's constitution that says you can't marry an American. But yes, the last time a British royal married an American divorcee, so for the last 80 years it's then shudders through the British monarchy, but Edward VIII was king at the time, and the monarch of the British monarch is the head of the church. And the church did not sanction divorce, so you can't have it both ways. You can't marry a divorced person and be the head of the church, so Edward had to take his pick. But Parliament also, and MI6, which is Britain's equivalent of the CIA, they knew that Edward and Wallace, who was his lady love, who was also married to her second husband at the time they became involved, she was still married, which is not Meghan's story. Meghan was already divorced at the time she and Harry met, and Harry was not the king. So it's a whole different ball of wax here. But what Parliament and MI6 knew was that both Edward and Wallace Simpson were Nazi sympathizers, and the year was 1936 when Hitler was Chancellor of Germany. And the last thing that the British Parliament wanted was a Nazi sympathizer puppet on the English throne.
So it's a good way to get rid of him.
Yeah, exactly. So to remind everybody that one American divorcee who married a royal does not equal every American divorcee who married a royal.
Exactly. And Meg, well, there are many differences, although, you know, up until I think quite recently, divorced people weren't even allowed in the box at Ascot.
Exactly. Very interesting, because the royal family is filled with adulterers, because up until very recently, really up until Prince William, royal marriages were arranged. Charles and Diana's marriage was arranged. It was really Prince Philip who said to Charles, hey, tick-tock, you're over 30. It's high time you stopped dithering and got married. And he was the one who really threw Diana in his way. And the two of them only had 13 chaperone dates before their engagement was announced. So we're talking up until the late 20th century when many, many, of course, Queen Elizabeth's match, Philip's own marriage was a love match, but most royal marriages up until fairly recently were arranged. They were treaties. They were political alliances. So it's really not such a stretch that there were so many adulterers among the royal family, because they weren't love matches. So there you have all these adulterers running around the palaces, but God forbid you should have a divorced person running around.
And now we have a princess. Oh, this I still get that thrill of a royal wedding. I think it's wonderful. I think it's delightful. I lived in England for a number of years, because when I was 21, when I was young, I read Jane Austen and I was obsessed with Jane Austen. And when I was 21, I went to England and I bought it. Cottage, actually, in England, not far from where Jane was born, because I just loved it. And I was there, actually, for that time of Diana's wedding. And so I remember all that excitement. And I love royal weddings. I get excited about it.
Nobody does it better than Britain. I mean, there are royal families in other parts of Europe, but the British monarchy has been consistent since, 1066 and all that, as they say. And the pomp and the circumstance and the fairy tale aspect of it, I think Americans in particular, because we speak the same language, we are absolutely fascinated by it. When I was there for the wedding of William and Kate, and I was standing there on Pall Mall with millions and millions of other people dressed in silly tinsel wigs and funny hats and waving flags, many of them were American.
Well, it is so, as you said, nobody does it better than the British. The pomp, the circumstance, all the colors, the horses, everything. It's always so wonderful.
And here, now we have a California girl whose ancestors on her mother's side were slaves on a Georgia plantation, marrying a grandson of the Queen of England. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, if somebody wrote it as a romance novel, half the readers would throw it against the wall and say, seriously?
Exactly. And so for those people who are unaware, tell us something about Meghan. Tell us about her background.
Meghan is, she likes to tell people that she's half Californian and half Pennsylvanian. Her father is white, her mother is black, and she grew up middle class in the San Fernando Valley. And her mother's family came from, originally, a Georgia plantation in the 1830s. And after the Civil War, they were freed slaves, and in what was known as the Great Migration, when during the First World War, when white men were drafted and went overseas, there were more economic opportunities for people of color. So the black side of her family moved north and west for economic opportunities, and eventually ended up in Southern California. Meghan's white side of the family, her father, some of them came over from England, and she may or may not have had an ancestor who worked as a domestic in Windsor Castle, and some of them came over from Germany, and the name was spelled Markle, M-A-R-K-E-L, and a census taker misspelled it once upon a time, to M-A-R-K-L-E, and that's how her name is now spelled. And they were impoverished. They came over here looking for a better life and ended up working in the coal mines of Pennsylvania. And she also may have had ancestors who were British who worked in the coal mines of England, as did Kate Middleton's ancestors. And her father grew up in a small town in the middle of Pennsylvania, and he had always dreamed of working as a technician in the movies, and working in lighting, except he was colorblind, and he kept that a secret. And he went off to Chicago and to become involved in the theater. And he met a woman named Rosalind Lovelace and had two kids by her. And they headed off to California, but he was very young then. He was only 20 when he met her. And the marriage didn't last because he really wasn't ready to be a young husband and father. But he became a top lighting designer for the soap opera General Hospital and the TV sitcom Married with Children. And he won a couple of Emmy Awards. And he also was a lighting director or consultant for the 1986 Olympics, or was it the 84 Olympics, whatever year that was, and the Emmy Awards right around that time. So he really made a name for himself and concealed his color blindness that whole time. And he met Megan's mother when she was working as a temp makeup artist in 1979, and they had a whirlwind courtship because they dated for a few months and were married on December 23rd, 1979, at a very sort of New Age church on Hollywood Boulevard. And 2 years later, Megan was born 6 days after Diana and Charles got married. So the story goes that Doria Ragland, who's Megan's mother, and Thomas Markle, Sr., Megan's father, were actually watching Diana and Charles get married on TV when Doria was just about to pop that baby. And, if, you know, who would have known that the second son of the people they were watching marry would get down on one knee 36 years later and propose to their daughter?
It really is, as you said, if somebody wrote that, it seems improbable and impossible, but it's happened. And I think it, you know, all of us, you know, have followed ever since Princess Diana came on. We've been following the royal family and what she went through, and of course for the boys as they grew up, we watched them grow up, and I think we're all very happy that Prince Harry has found somebody.
Exactly. As happy as we were for William, and so, you know, in tears. People were actually in tears on the mall. Total strangers. You know, he's finally gotten his happily ever after. After 10 years, he's married Kate, and they had these loudspeakers on the mall so that everyone could hear the ceremony in Westminster Abbey. And when they said their I do's, these cheers went up. And I think it's exponentially more for Harry, because he's the one that the whole world watched go through so much. I mean, William was the steady one. We didn't see William get involved in drunken brawls and punching photographers, and we didn't hear about him having as much, really, you know, boozy nights. And Harry had so many issues with being the wild child and acting out and doing ill-conceived things like wearing a Nazi uniform to a costume party, or, you know, going to with his mates to Vegas and playing strip poker and, you know, having a photo of it.
I mean, I think we were all happy that he's grown up, that he's...
Exactly. He got through it all, and now he really has the happily ever after that he deserved. He's come through the other end with flying colors and a soulmate who understands him, and he's grown up and gotten past it all.
And finding a purpose in life and realizing how much good he can do by his charity work.
Exactly.
And how very, very much it means to people. Because this is one of the things that I think is, it's wonderful in both of these men, is that you get the feeling that they're going to be different. They now understand what love is and what it means not to hurt their wives. I really feel that both of them will understand what it means. They went through it with their mother, and that mm-hmm. they don't want to repeat that history. And I think
exactly.
maybe they've because of the horrific thing that happened with their mother. You get the feeling that they're going to have a deeper relationship with their wives.
I agree, absolutely. And Megan, too, is a child of divorce. Her parents separated when she was 2 and divorced when she was 6 or 7. So she and Harry connect on that level as well. Both of them understand what that's like to go through. Now, if her parents were extremely amicable and made sure that she knew that she was loved and cherished, which is, yeah, she says she never saw her parents fight, which, of course, is the opposite of what Harry witnessed. But Megan can understand, at least as a child of divorce, at a young age, what Harry went through. But I think both Harry and William have embodied the kindness and compassion and empathy and humanitarianism that their mother had.
Exactly.
And I think, and Harry has found himself a fellow humanitarian, which all of his previous girlfriends were pleasant women, but it wasn't, I mean, one of Megan's other professions, as it were, in addition to being a professional actress, is that she is a humanitarian. That's her other thing. Something, you know, she's walked the walk and talked the talk for years. And it was another deep level that they connected on immediately, was their desire to make the world better, especially for children in underdeveloped countries. That was sort of the first thing they connected on.
Well, it was,
as Megan said, that's what got date 2 in the books.
Well, it was interesting. As an actress, she was really getting, she had a great role, and she was really moving ahead in her career, but she did have this interest in helping others.
Yes, which she had since childhood. Another thing that, as improbable on paper as this relationship would seem, this girl from the San Fernando Valley and a boy who grew up in Kensington Palace, one thing they both had in common was each had a mother who took them from childhood to homeless shelters and who taught them to have kindness and compassion and empathy for those who have less than them, and to treat even the least among us with dignity, and took them to soup kitchens, and, as I said, took them to homeless shelters and had them participate and roll up their sleeves and get involved side by side in humanitarian causes. And so Megan has been doing that since she was a little kid. She would, you know, her parents would show by doing to give their spare change to the homeless person on the street, to reach out, and her teachers, where she went to progressive schools to say, you reach out and touch a person, a hug can go a long way, which is something that Princess Diana actually did. Megan is very huggy, which is not very royal. Diana was the first person to do that, to actually give physical contact to somebody, because it means so much to give a cuddle, you know, as the boys would say. And when she was 13, she started helping out on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And Diana took her boys to Passages, which is a homeless shelter in London. So it's something that both of them have been doing since they were very young. And Harry, in particular, getting involved with children in Africa, in the Sotho, with his Santa Bale charity.
Now, how soon after they met did he introduce her to the royal family?
He started introducing her slowly, but it wasn't for several months. She didn't meet the queen until it was many months later, I believe. She didn't officially meet the queen until last fall, or late last summer. But she was slowly being introduced to Harry's father and Camilla and William and Kate, because she was visiting, she was making surreptitious visits to Nottingham Cottage, nicknamed Not Cut, where Harry lives on the Kensington Palace grounds. And, of course, William and Kate live in apartment 1A, which is just a stone's throw away. So she was meeting William and Kate, excuse me, before she met some of the others, and playing with little Princess Charlotte, kind of to see if she'd get along with kids, I suppose. So that was kind of her test drive.
Well, you know, I have to take a quick commercial break, but hold on, because when we come back, we're going to talk about the wedding, about Windsor Castle, about the dress, about all of that good stuff, okay?
Oh, good.
Just hold on. We'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I, or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with a very, very special guest today, Leslie Carroll, and we are talking about the American Princess, the love story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. Leslie, it is so exciting to know that you're going to be part of this entire event. You're flying out to London and
yes.
Going to Windsor. Now, let's tell people about Windsor. Many times, you know, when Americans go to England, sometimes they don't, you know, they're so busy in London, there's so much to see. So unless they're making their second or third trip, they don't actually get out to Windsor, which is a shame because I love the little town of Windsor, and I love Windsor Castle.
Windsor Castle is the oldest royal residence and continuously occupied. It was originally built during the reign of William the Conqueror. So we're starting 1066, the beginning of all that. And continuously occupied, it's said to be Queen Elizabeth's favorite royal residence, so she goes out there whenever she can. It's about an hour west of London in the county of Berkshire, which Americans would say Berkshire, but no, that's not it. It's not like our Berkshire Mountains. And it is a lovely, charming, old town, a one block town. It looks like an old Tudor town, of course, modernized since. And it's right across the River Thames from Eton, which is where both Harry and William went to school. And this is where the royal wedding will take place. And it's going to be a rather modest affair in comparison to where William and Kate got married in Westminster Abbey and where Charles and Diana got married in St. Paul's Cathedral. And Harry is far more low-key. William's low-key, too, except that because William is directly in line to the throne, his wedding was a state occasion. Harry's wedding is not a state occasion, which is why you will not see heads of state as invited guests to his wedding. And unlike Westminster Abbey, which holds 1,900 or 2,000 people, the St. George's Chapel, which is where Harry and Meghan's wedding will take place, is far more intimate, comparatively speaking. It holds about 800 people. And apparently 600 invitations have gone out to the church service, which will take place at noon, London time. And it's a beautiful, beautiful chapel that was built in the 16th century. And it's also home to the Order of the Garter, which is the oldest order of chivalry.
I actually have a chunk of the chapel.
How did you get that?
Well, we were touring the castle. We had brought our sons there shortly after the 9/11, a few months after that, and they were doing new, you know, and improved security measures, and they were actually drilling holes in places where they were putting sensors, and there was a man who was actually picking up, like a butler type person who was taking each wherever they were taking chunks out, and he was collecting it. And they were not giving this away. I mean, these are pieces of the cat, you know. And I just couldn't resist. And my boys were absolutely delightful, and they were dressed up because we were going to Windsor, and I wanted them to look nice. You know, they were in suits and they looked like real gentlemen. And I said to the man, I said, could I have a piece? and he turned and he saw my boys stand, and my boys, of course, were embarrassed, like, what's she doing? What's mommy doing?
It's just rubble.
And so I got it, and it's a treasure to me, just because you're right. It's 1066. The castle's from 1066. It's mind blowing. And so I just love it. It's such a beautiful building. It's the rooms, the state apartments are unbelievable.
And of course, Queen Mary's dollhouse is
there.
Oh
my goodness! Isn't that beautiful?
And Queen Mary that we are talking about was the queen consort of George V, who is the grandfather of the current queen, Elizabeth II.
So the wedding...
Queen Mary was also the kleptomaniac, so it is said. She tended to covet sparkly things.
Okay. All right. That's pretty good. Now, so the wedding is at noon, and we know that because it interferes... interviews with something very important in England.
Well, the World Cup match is supposed to take place at 5:30 in the evening, and that is the soccer match, football to Brits, soccer to us Americans. And Prince William is the president of the FIFA, FIFA Association, and he usually presents the trophy to the winner. So he was going to have to make a terribly Solomonic choice to run back and forth. I mean, the wedding itself, the ceremony, takes place at 12, and then at 1 o'clock there's going to be this wonderful horse and carriage ride through the town of Windsor so that everybody who is gathered in the town can see the bride and groom right after the nuptials and all of that. And There can't be a kiss on the balcony because there is no balcony at Windsor, and the chapel itself is not actually at, you know, it's not in the castle. It's not the thing. It's not like Buckingham Palace. So William would have had to make a terrible choice, and it was very funny because Harry had not directly asked him to be his best man for months. Everybody sort of assumed that William would be his best man, just as Harry was William's best man. And the reception, there are going to be two receptions. One is called the wedding breakfast, which doesn't take place at breakfast time at all, but that's what the Brits call it. It's lunch. And then an evening reception. The first is hosted by the Queen. The wedding breakfast is hosted by the Queen, and then there's an evening reception at the beautiful Frogmore House, which was very dear to Victoria and Albert. And that's where the engagement photos were taken, and that's hosted by Prince Charles. But William was going to have to dash back and forth the 23 miles to go to the footy match and present the cup, and I think he's giving it up in order to be at the reception as well, or else he's going to actually be hightailing it on the highway.
Well, he can do
back and forth and back and forth.
he can take his helicopter. He can fly it himself.
I was just thinking the same thing. He's a helicopter pilot. Yeah. I can just see him landing on the field.
That's what I think he should do. Now, talking about Queen Elizabeth, what's the talk about it? Does she like Meghan?
Yes, rumor has it she likes Meghan very much. First of all, I love to call Queen Elizabeth the hardest working woman in show business. She's going to be 92 next week. And certainly she's slowed down a good deal on the number of royal engagements she does. But she still does more than anybody else. And she loves working women. And certainly Meghan as a career woman and an adult, a mature woman, let's put it that way. She's been an independent woman for years. That should impress the Queen. The fact that she adores Harry and the Queen adores Harry, they have something in common. And it's important at this stage in the Queen's life that her grandsons are extremely happy and that Harry has finally centered and matured and found love. I'm sure the Queen is delighted. And, you know, for anybody who kind of wants to open that Pandora's box, I've read from numerous royal biographers that the Queen doesn't have a racist bone in her body. For, you know, people who want to go there.
I wouldn't think that she did, because I think she's a very intelligent woman and she understands the world. Her only problem, I think, with Diana was... Diana was so young and so immature at the time that it was almost impossible, I think, for those two to get along.
Well, it was a horrific mismatch, and I think the Queen was perfectly aware of what Diana was aware of, was that there were three people in that marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
Yeah.
You know, that famous quote, and the Queen was furious about Camilla's involvement in the marriage. And I suppose it's impossible to know what the Queen was thinking. Maybe she did expect Diana to keep a stiff upper lip and carry on and just deal with it. I don't know.
Well, probably.
Diana was not equipped to do that. Most women wouldn't. I mean, there were many, 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 many royal wives who were used to, as Charles said, you know, every royal man before me has had a mistress, so deal with it. That's what he supposedly said to Diana. Well, she wasn't equipped to deal with that. I mean, her father had a mistress, and her, you know, her father wasn't around, and her mother up and left the family to marry a wallpaper magnate when Diana was 6 or 7. So
it was different.
Look at her own path.
But I think that this new wedding is very exciting. Now, do we know yet about the dress?
We do not know about the dress, and speculation has been like a horse race. The morning line odds change every day. If she were British, it would be easier to narrow it down because British brides tend to choose British couturiers. But Meghan being American, we could go anywhere with this because, as David Starkey, the royal historian, has said, she's really the first international bride we've had. Kensington Palace had requested sketches back in December from an Israeli haute couturier named Inbal Dror, and then Ms. Dror sent three sketches, and those went public. So it's almost a guarantee that you would not be picking Ms. Dror because you never reveal the dress until the final minute. But she has a friend in a French designer, Roland Mouret. There's Erdem, who, and many of these designers, while they may be based, for instance, Erdem, I believe, is technically Canadian-based, except he's not from Canada. There's the Ralph and Russo, who are originally Australian but based in England, and they designed the gown that she wore in her engagement photos. Victoria Beckham, who's become a friend of hers, but she's not a wedding gown designer. Misha Nunu, who was born in Bahrain and who designed that white shirt she wore in the Invictus Games that's called the husband shirt, but Misha Nunu is not a wedding dress designer either. There's Sarah Burton from the House of Alexander McQueen, who, of course, designed Kate's wedding dress. There's Stuart Parvin, who is the Queen's couturier. I mean, we could go on forever.
So, when will we...
any number of them, yeah.
When will we know?
We will probably know the day of, unless there's some sort of sneak. Yeah, when we'll have the day before the wedding... Well,
As long as none of the people from Washington are involved, there might not be a leak.
And none of the people from Washington are invited because it's not a state occasion. What happened with William and Kate's wedding was that Sarah Burton was caught. It was April, of course, the end of April, and she was sneaking into the Goring Hotel with the gown. And she was wearing a parka with a fur trimmed hood. But she always tends to wear the same thing. She wears jeans and flats and a striped T-shirt. And somebody recognized her little uniform and said, "Oh, my God, that's Sarah Burton. Oh, I guess that's who's designing the dress." So there were snapshots taken of her entering the Goring Hotel, which was where Kate's family was staying before the wedding. So they're like, "Oh, that must be who's designing the dress."
Okay, well, let's hope they're able to keep a state secret there better than they are. They are around Washington, D.C.
That's right.
And speaking of April.
But this dress will probably cost at least anywhere from $400,000 to $500,000 is what I've read.
Ooh.
Although it may not cost as much as Kate's because Kate will be a future queen. Depends on what article you're reading on what day.
Now,
and who you want to believe.
are the royal wedding dresses, are they, I haven't seen them. Are they somewhere to be seen?
Kate's was on tour. In July of 2011, her dress was on display at Buckingham Palace along with all the other wedding paraphernalia. And then it went on tour. It's currently in Australia, which is why people are saying if Meghan will wear a tiara, she can't wear the one Kate wore because it's in Australia right now on display.
Now, there are many things that Meghan's had to learn in the past few months, right?
She's had to learn all sorts of etiquette. I mean, ridiculous things like, you know, how to sit properly so the camera can't get up your skirt, which, I mean, she would know how to do anyway as an actress doing all sorts of appearances on television and all of that. She's not going to pull any Britney Spears moments. She's not that sort of actress. But, you know, there's all kinds of royal protocol. If you've ever seen the way those tables are set up for dining, there's a million forks and glasses and all of that. And there's a certain protocol, obviously, of which fork to use and when. But you have to learn how to eat. I mean, how to put peas on the back of your fork and to eat properly the way the British royals do it so that you don't have to think about, you know, conversing with the Minister of Foreign Affairs from wherever because you have already learned how to get peas on the back of your fork. So you're not thinking about that. And she's had to go through hostage training in case she's taken hostage. She's probably had to go through defensive driving courses, too. She's had to learn all of the names through, you know, all of the basic protocol of who's who and what's what and how to address everybody and whom to curtsy to and when. And who's supposed to curtsy to her and when. There's a lot she has to memorize. As an actress, it shouldn't be that hard for her to memorize things because she's used to memorizing things.
And well, she's stepping into the role of a lifetime.
Exactly.
Now, I was thinking about that pea thing. The few times that I've eaten peas, when I've had to eat them in front of people, because I don't like peas very much.
I don't either. I would just not eat the peas.
No, what I do is I spear one at a time. So
exactly, which is what you're not supposed to do. No spearing the peas. You're supposed to, I don't know how they do it. You're supposed to somehow, I think, move the peas with your knife onto the back of your fork or something. I don't know how you do it without them rolling off. This would take me days. And how to hold the teacup and balance it. They're not kidding about the pinky, but you balance it so that, I don't think you really raise the pinky. You balance the teacup with the handle between your thumb and forefinger, and then use your third finger to steady the cup so it doesn't wobble when it's full of liquid. I've tried this. This is not easy.
No, actually, I don't think you're supposed to put your pinky out because I think...
No, you're not. It looks really silly.
Yes, actually, when you're in Fortnum and Mason's, if you see somebody with their pinky out, you know that they're American. Because Americans... yes, really.
And
Fortnum and Mason's is one of my favorite...
I love it.
The tea room there is fantastic.
You have to have tea at Claridge's. Claridge's afternoon tea is so, so wonderful. I once said that if I was ever going to have a nervous breakdown, I would do it in Claridge's. I mean, if I was ever going to use it as a sanatorium, because Claridge's is just so wonderful.
Well, this, you know, it is so exciting that you're going to, how many days are you going to be there? You're going to be there in advance?
I'll be there about 5 days,
And doing some taping and just being able to talk about everything. Do you know the menu for both of the breakfast?
They have not released the menu, but if I know Megan, she's into healthy eating and is mostly vegan. I think it's going to be one of those healthy California type things. The Brits are going to be very surprised. Well, the chef that they chose for the wedding cake is, her name is Claire P-T-A-K. I don't want to mangle the pronunciation. It could be tack, it could be patak, I'm not sure. But she's from the Violet Bakery in Hackney, London, but she was trained under Alice Waters of Chez Panisse in Berkeley. And the wedding cake is going to be a lemon elderflower cake with buttercream frosting decorated with fresh flowers. And they say it's going to be, all the flavors of spring will be represented in the cake. And I wish that they would post the recipe for lemon elderflower. And if you don't know what elderflower tastes like, if you've ever tasted Saint-Germain-Lacour, that's elderflower.
And okay.
It's really delicious.
It's
sort of light and sweet. And I have an elderflower cupcake recipe somewhere. It's really good.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. When you're over there, I'm sure you can, get the recipe.
I want a slice of that cake. Well, they're opening up they invited 1,200, children who had demonstrated humanitarian and philanthropic bona fides. And they're going to be on the grounds of Windsor Castle, I guess, watching the wedding on a big screen or something. And several people who work at Windsor Castle, they'd invited a number of people to watch the wedding and had said they wanted to share the cake. I don't think they're going to be sharing the cake with those of us who are going to be watching from the street.
And probably, I'm wondering if they're going to be serving quinoa.
I would not be surprised.
That
if
I was
they
just thinking.
Were serving quinoa at the wedding, at the reception, the evening reception. Well, you know, Prince Charles is into organic farming and all of that stuff, so. It would not surprise me at all if he and Meghan had, you know, long, deep conversations about organic farming and healthy food.
Oh, well, I'm sure there will. There,
I don't think we're going to see pigs in blankets and sliders.
Yeah, but I'm sure that at some of the places you go, they will be recreating or trying to recreate the recipes that are going to be served at these meals. So that's it's so exciting. So you have that, you have the cake, and we know, of course, do we know who's from Meghan's side of the family who's going to be there?
I think certainly her mother will be there. I believe her father's going to be there. There was a lot of talk about whether or not her father would walk her down the aisle because he's living very retired in Rosarito Beach, Mexico, and is, quote, semi-reclusive, not a big people person, doesn't go in much for large crowds and giving big speeches and all of that. And there was a rumor that Meghan might break royal tradition by being the one to stand up on behalf of her family and thank the guests. No one's quite sure what's going to happen with that. I'm sure her father would love to be there, you know, if I'm invited. And there was a time a few years when Meghan was a teen when she and her father had some sort of estrangement. I don't know why. But when she was a little girl, she was very much a daddy's girl. And a couple of years ago, she posted something really sweet, a sweet Father's Day message to him on her Instagram feed. So I don't think there's any bad blood between them. It would only be because he just
doesn't want to be
in the
crowd, because it is going to be quite a spectacle, even though, you know, it's not as large. When you have a little place like Windsor, you get a lot of people. It's going to be crowded.
Well, and also he has the eyes of the world are on him, and the media has not been kind to the entire Markle family.
There's so much ugliness, and I really think that, you know, sometimes people just get over it and be nice. And as we're talking about St. George's Chapel, which is also, you know, the spiritual home of the world's oldest order of chivalry, the Order of the Garter.
Exactly.
And which is inspired by Arthurian, you know, King Arthur's
exactly.
legend.
Exactly.
And
the motto, "Onisua qui malipense," means evil to him who thinks evil.
Well, I think that's
which I like to translate as, you know, karma's going to get you.
Exactly. So I think that, yeah, they should put that right up there. All especially all of these reporters who they're so. I mean, you're there to delight in the spectacle, to delight in
and
the wedding.
And that's what American Princess is about.
Exactly.
I mean, the subtitle of the book is the love story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And the book in alternating chapters is set up as a double biography of both of them, and then as they meet, the story of their courtship, and then hypothesizing what the royal marriage will be like for them and the wedding day will be like, because of course we haven't gotten there yet and the book comes out on Tuesday.
So it comes out next Tuesday.
But it's supposed to be a celebration of this improbable and what a generation ago even would have been an unthinkable and a couple generations ago would have been an impermissible love story.
And I think it's wonderful to have this. It's a biracial marriage. It's a marriage of two people who really care about other people, not just
exactly.
themselves. And
I love it. And all you need to do is look at the way the two of them look at each other. Oh, my God. They're clearly so in love.
So I hope that all of those people who you know, the press people who just are always out there for some salacious nonsense will just take a deep breath and say, let's have a moment of real happiness and share in this joy, and let's make it joyous for them and for all the watchers. And there's going to be so many, tens of millions of people are going to watch this event, and we want it to be fun, and we don't need a lot of bad background. We need really to think of a wonderful future. And so you're right. I hope that they will remember evil to him who thinks evil. But they will absolutely, everybody should read your book, American Princess, because it is delightful. Your books are always so wonderful. And there are many more books there. When they go to Amazon, they can look up other books.
In fact, we have a new release this morning, Notorious Royal Marriages.
Oh, that's a good one.
Journey of 9 centuries of dynasty, destiny, and desire. Just this morning, there's the e-book release, only in e-book form of this. There's 2 brand new chapters, one on William and Kate and one on Harry and Meghan, only in the e-book version, just as of this morning, a new release. And that's actually material, some of it won't even be in American Princess. So that's new stuff that won't be in any of my royal books because of when American Princess had to go to press. So brand new stuff on Harry and Meghan, and brand new stuff on William and Kate, only in the ebook version of Notorious
from Leslie,
starting today.
Leslie Carroll. And Leslie, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's always a joy to talk to you, and I'll have you back soon, and we can talk about. Let's have you back after the wedding, sometime in May, and you can tell us about it. How about that?
Yes, thank you, Patsy. I would love to, and it's always a joy to speak with you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye, thank you. Sure, bye-bye.
Okay, woo! Royal wedding, that's exciting. Okay, good. That was fun. That was lots of fun. I'm looking forward to that, and it's going to be May 19th, and I'm sure that millions of people all over the world will be listening, and you can see Leslie will be on with CBS. She will be the commentator there and talking about all of the events. And she knows, she has written so many books about royal weddings. She knows all the background of all the kings and queens and all of the gossip behind all of their weddings. So she's lots of fun, and we'll have her back in May to talk about her adventures in Windsor. Meanwhile, I want to remind everyone that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or to see them spoken on the big screen or the little screen. And just the only way that's going to happen is if you actually get out there and start writing. So thank you very much, and I'm going to have coming up Jeffrey Deaver, David Baldacci, and many other wonderful guests. So make sure you tune in and to Joy on Paper whenever you can. Thank you. Bye.